And again, Father, we ask that you bless our Bible study tonight. Just speak to our hearts in Jesus' name. Amen. You know, in Hosea chapter 8, verse 7, the prophet predicts God's judgment on Israel. And he says this, they sow the wind and reap the whirlwind. In other words, the seeds of rebellion produce a disproportionate harvest. Just a few seeds of rebellion and sin can reap a bumper crop of devastation. Proverbs 22 verse 8 says it again, he who sows iniquity will reap sorrow. And both these verses apply to David. When he invited Bathsheba to his room for a few night games, he had no idea the devastation and the sadness that he was inviting into his life. Pain invaded and ransacked his heart, his home, even the entire nation. At the end of chapter 17, David is suffering the consequences. He's sleeping in Mahanaim, a city east of the Jordan River outside the borders of his kingdom. What is the king doing outside his kingdom? Why is the king an alien from his own capital? Well, his renegade son Absalom is the problem. Absalom has launched a coup d'etat to unseat David from power. You know, the name Absalom means father of peace. And yet, tragically, Absalom was one Bible character whose name did not reflect his nature. There was nothing at all peaceful about Absalom's motivations or his manners or his maneuvers. Absalom resented the mistakes and weaknesses that he saw in his father David, to the point where they blinded him of his dad's many noble and godly traits. Absalom rallied together other bitter men, and they led this revolt against David. At first, it was so successful that David was forced to abandon the capital city of Jerusalem. He fled across the Jordan River to Mahanaim. And in order to solidify his throne, Absalom now rallies an army, and his intention is to capture and kill the king. He figures that when he executes his father David, all Israel will serve him as their sovereign. Well, in chapter 18, the showdown takes place. And David numbered the people who were with him and set captains of thousands and captains of hundreds over them. Then David sent out one third of the people under the hand of Joab, one third under the hand of Abishai, the son of Zeruiah, Joab's brother, and one third under the hand of Ittai the Gittite. And the king said to the people, I also will surely go out with you myself. Now you remember, the marring mistake in David's life was his sin with Bathsheba. And it happened, you remember this, when he stayed at home rather than go to battle. David's not going to let that mistake happen twice. He's rallied his troops. He's divided them in thirds. He set them under generals. But he says, hey, I will surely go out with you myself. But the people answered, you shall not go out. For if we flee away, they will not care about us. Nor if half of us die, they will care about us. But you are worth 10,000 of us now. For you are now more help to us in the city. Then the king said to them, whatever seems best to you, I will do. So the king stood beside the gate, and all the people went out by hundreds and by thousands. David gets bumped from combat. That's what happens. And he does so for three reasons. First, he was the prey that the enemy was after. The foe would fight harder if they saw King David in the battle opposing them. All they really wanted to do was capture him. The second reason he was bumped from combat is that if the people were overcome, then David was still behind to call for reinforcements. And then, of course, the third reason is his own troops doubted how hard David would fight because he was fighting against his own flesh and blood, his own son, Absalom. And here's why they questioned David's resolve. Notice this. Now, the king had commanded Joab, Abishai, and Ittai, saying, deal gently for my sake with the young man Absalom. And all the people heard when the king gave all the captains orders concerning Absalom. deal gently are not the words that rally the troops to fight hard. This was discouraging to David's own troops. They were risking their lives in a bloody battle with Absalom's army. This was a fight to the death, and all they could hear their leader say is, "Deal gently with my son Absalom." Of course, David had the heart of a true father. And despite his son's rebellion and animosity, despite the fact that Absalom had broken David's heart, he still loved his son. Charles Spurgeon wrote of David, "It is a father that speaks, and a father's love can survive the enmity of a son." Isn't it interesting how a child can never quench the love of their parents? Our children can rebel. They can defy the things we love dearly, and yet they're still our children. You cannot unchild a child. They are your child, and you love them forever. And not only was this David's heart toward his son Absalom, I hope you know this is God's heart toward us. Despite our years of rebellion, you know what God says to you? You know what God says about you? You know what he says to the angels in heaven as they oversee affairs and interact with the dealings of man? You know what God says to his troops? He says, "Deal gently. Deal gently with them. Deal gently with her. Oh, I know she's been rebellious, and I know she's leading a coup d'etat, and she's risen up and rebelling against the thing, but deal gently with her. I love her. Oh, I know that he's a rebel. You know, I know that he's full of animosity in him, but deal gently with him. He's still my son. I still love him." Oh my, how God loves us. God always says, "Deal gently." Verse 6, "So the people went out into the field of battle against Israel, and the battle was in the woods of Ephraim. And the people of Israel were overthrown there before the servants of David, and a great slaughter of 20,000 took place there that day. For the battle there was scattered over the face of the whole countryside, and the woods devoured more people that day than the sword devoured." In other words, the terrain was a factor in the outcome of this battle. Men were fighting in the forested mountains. They were fighting alongside steep ledges and surrounded by caves and drop-offs. And it minimized the importance of numbers. It reduced the battle to man-on-man, face-to-face combat. And of course, these conditions favored the more experienced men, the more experienced soldiers, the men of David. And this meant a great victory for David's army. Then Absalom met the servants of David. And Absalom rode on a mule. And why he was on a mule, I don't have a clue. Just seems strange, doesn't it? Unless he thought that somehow the mule gave him some kind of advantage in the forest. I mean, that's a possibility. Maybe the steep terrain or whatever, he thought the mule would give him more stability. I'm sure it wasn't the case, but it could have been that the mule was a symbol of his own stubbornness. But I'm sure that probably wasn't part of his thinking. Absalom evidently was lost. He was cut off from his men. And he happens upon the enemy's patrol, and he decides to get out of Dodge here. I mean, he doesn't want to fight these men on his own, and so he kicks the mule into high gear, if that's possible. And he tries to escape the encounter. Now, let's go back a few chapters. Remember 2 Samuel chapter 14, verses 25 and 26. You remember there we had a description of Absalom's appearance. I'll quote it. "Now in all Israel there was no one who was praised as much as Absalom for his good looks. From the sole of his foot to the crown of his head, there was no blemish in him." And you remember the trait that made him so handsome? It was his long hair. Isn't it amazing how women love long hair? There he is right there. It's just amazing how women love long hair, especially this time of year. Here's another example. Women go nuts over guys with long hair. It's amazing. And Absalom, he kept his hair long. As a matter of fact, he had one annual haircut a year. We're told back in chapter 14, and when he cut the hair of his head, at the end of the year, of every year, he cut it because it was heavy on him. And when he cut it, he weighed the hair on his head at 200 shekels, according to the king's standard. 200 shekels weighed 6 pounds. My, oh my, that's a head of hair. Absalom obviously had this coarse, thick, bushy hair. Absalom had a fro. There he is right there. That's a photograph of Absalom, or as close as I could get. Now, his hair is the detail you need to keep in mind when we read this next line. The mule went under the thick boughs of a great terebinth tree, and his head caught in the terebinth. So he was left hanging between heaven and earth. And the mule which was under him went on. The implication is that his long, bushy, thick hair caught in the branches of the tree. You know, a terebinth tree is like a thick scrub. Trapp writes in his commentary, so he hung between heaven and earth as rejected by both. He literally got his hair tangled up in the tree and he couldn't get it untangled, and the mule went out from under him, and there he is, poor Absalom, just hanging around. Seriously speaking, this is a hairy ordeal. This is a hair-raising situation. Absalom literally is up in the air over this situation. I mean, you might say that he's up a tree. Verse 10 tells us, now a certain man saw it, and he told Joab, and he said, I just saw Absalom hanging in a terebinth tree. That's all a strange thing, you know. This guy we're fighting, he's hanging around in a tree. And so Joab said to the man who told him, you just saw him? And why did you not strike him there to the ground? I would have given you 10 shekels of silver and a belt. You would have been rewarded had you killed him. You just saw him. Well, you're walking through the wood. Oh, there's Absalom. You come running back and tell us? But the man said to Joab, though I were to receive 1,000 shekels of silver in my hand, I would not raise my hand against the king's son. For in our hearing, the king commanded you and Abishai and Ittai, saying, beware lest anyone touch the young man Absalom. Oh my, this soldier had paid attention. He had heard the orders that David had given to his generals. Otherwise, I would have dealt falsely against my own life, for there is nothing hidden from the king, and you yourself would have set yourself against me. Then Joab said, I just can't stand this. I cannot linger with you. And he took 3 spears in his hand, and he thrust them through Absalom's heart while he was still alive in the midst of the terebinth tree. And 10 young men who bore Joab's armor surrounded Absalom and struck and killed him. The first man on the scene fears and respects the king. His desire is to obey his king, not slay his son. But Joab, he doesn't hesitate in the slightest. Without batting an eye, he grabs 3 spears and he thrusts them through Absalom's heart. And his 10 men finish the job. Joab seemed to love David. He certainly supported him and was faithful to him. But it seems that long ago he had lost respect for the king. He had watched David indulge his kids and never discipline them. He knew the same would be the case even after Absalom's rebellion. David still would do something silly, invite him back perhaps, or, you know, somehow ignore it all. And Joab just couldn't stand by and watch all this happen again. David's sons rebel, and David ignored, and David not disciplined them. He couldn't stand it. And I'm sure he rationalized in his own mind, this is a no-brainer. I'm just doing what David doesn't have the guts to do. Though you sympathize with Joab, something is missing in his attitude. You know, David proved with Saul that if you respect God's authority, God is fully capable of dealing with the authority when and how it suits him. But you see, that kind of reaction takes faith. Faith that Joab lacks. In his book, A Tale of Three Kings, Gene Edwards, he imagines David saying, "This throne is not mine, not to have, not to take, not to protect, and not to keep. This throne is the Lord's." You see, neither Saul, nor Abner, nor Absalom, nor Joab, nor anyone else alive at the time had that kind of an attitude except David. I didn't seek to gain this throne. I'm not going to fight to protect it. God gave it to me. If he wants me to have it, he'll ensure that I keep it. Only David had that kind of attitude. And perhaps that's why God loved David as much as he did. It seems that David's treasure was in the Lord and in nothing else. And so Joab blew the trumpet, and the people returned from pursuing Israel. For Joab held back the people, and they took Absalom and cast him into a large pit in the woods and laid a very large heap of stones over him. And then all Israel fled, every one to his tent, all who had sided with Absalom. Now Absalom in his lifetime had taken and set up a pillar for himself, which is in the king's valley. In other words, Absalom had established his own memorial. For he said, "I have no son to keep my name in remembrance." In chapter 14, verse 27, we're told that Absalom had three sons, but apparently they had died long before their father. We're told he called the pillar after his own name, and to this very day, it is called Absalom's Monument. Now, there is a site today in the Kidron Valley at the bottom of the Mount of Olives known as Absalom's Tomb, but it's not. The structure was constructed in the first century B.C. It's not Absalom's tomb. We're told here in the scriptures that Joab threw Absalom into a pit and threw some rocks on top of it. That's Absalom's tomb. This was a later development. Then Ahimaaz, the son of Zadok, said, "Let me run now and take the news to the king, how the Lord has avenged him of his enemies." And Joab said to him, "You shall not take the news this day, for you shall take the news another day. But today you shall take no news, because the king's son is dead." In other words, he knows how David's going to react when he hears that his son is dead. The news of the victory is going to drown out. It's going to be drowned out by the news of his son. I mean, David's not even going to pay any attention to the victory. He's going to be so overwhelmed by the death of Absalom. Then Joab said to the Cushite, "Go tell the king what you have seen." And so the Cushite bowed himself to Joab and ran. And Ahimaaz, the son of Zadok, said again to Joab, "But whatever happens, please let me also run after the Cushite." And Joab said, "Why will you run, my son, since you have no news ready? But whatever happens... He said, "Let me run." And so he said to him, "Run." And so two messengers are dispatched with the news. Then Ahimaaz ran by the way of the plain and outran the Cushite. Now David was sitting between the two gates, and the watchman went up to the roof over the gate to the wall, lifted his eyes and looked, and there was a man running alone. Then the watchman cried out and told the king, and the king said, "If he is alone, there is news in his mouth." And he came rapidly and drew near. Then the watchman saw another man running, and the watchman called to the gatekeeper and said, "There is another man running alone." And the king said, "He also brings news." And so the watchman said, "I think the running of the first is like the running of Ahimaaz, the son of Zadok." And the king said, "He is a good man, and he comes with good news." And Ahimaaz called out and said to the king, "All is well." Then he bowed down with his face to the earth before the king, and he said, "Blessed be the Lord your God, who has delivered up the men who raised their hand against the Lord the king." And the king said, "Is the young man Absalom safe?" In other words, before he celebrates the victory, David wants to know about the welfare of his son. "What about my son?" And Ahimaaz answered, "When Joab sent the king's servant and me, your servant, I saw a great tumult, but I did not know what it was about. And the king said, turn aside and stand here. So he turned aside and stood still. Now, Ahimaaz knows exactly what had happened. Absalom is dead. He knows it, but he lies to David. Just then the Cushite came. And the Cushite said, there is good news, my lord the king. For the Lord has avenged you this day of all those who rose against you. And the king said to the Cushite, is the young man Absalom safe? And so the Cushite answered, and evidently he just blurted it out. May the enemies of my lord the king and all who rise against you to do harm be like that young man. Verse 33. Then the king was deeply moved. The idea behind the wording is that he went into a violent trembling and shaking. It upset him so. And he went up to the chamber over the gate and he wept. And as he went, he said thus, oh, my son Absalom, my son Absalom, if only I had died in your place. Oh, Absalom, my son, my son. When David hears the report, rather than rejoice in the efforts and in the outcome of his troops, he becomes totally absorbed in the grief over the death of his own son Absalom. Five times in verse 33, five times, you can count them, David cries out, my son. He is brokenhearted. Again, Charles Spurgeon writes this, our children may plunge into the worst of sins, but they are our children still. They may scoff at our God. They may tear our heart to pieces with their wickedness. We cannot take complacency in them. But at the same time, we cannot unchild them nor erase their image from our hearts. This is the love of a parent for a child, even a rebellious child. You know, it's also possible that David realized just how responsible he had been for his son's, you know, development and for the suspect character of his son. You know, David was the one who had set the bad example, certainly. David's insensitivity had opened the door for Amnon's sin when Amnon raped Absalom's sister. And David's failure to discipline Amnon had caused Absalom to feel like he had to take matters into his own hands. He was the one who then killed Amnon. And this whole thing, you know, David must have thought, wow, what a tangled web I've weaved. David's unwillingness to forgive, his unwillingness to discipline, David's own lusts were mimicked by his son. All of these things combined, I'm sure, to add to David's grief. He's lost his son, and he feels that it's his own fault. Chapter 19. And Joab was told, behold, the king is weeping and mourning for Absalom. And so the victory that day was turned into mourning for all the people. For the people heard it said that day, the king is grieved for his son. And the people stole back into the city that day, as people who are ashamed steal away when they flee in battle. But the king covered his face, and the king cried out with a loud voice, O my son Absalom, O Absalom, my son, my son. Now Joab knows David, and he tries to be sympathetic. But Joab is also a general. And his biggest concern is for the morale of his troops. And this is just not right in his mind. Men have risked their lives for David. And now he's ignoring their sacrifice and he's mourning over the death of the leader of the rebellion. David is sending the wrong message to his men and to his people. And his actions may prove to be more damaging than Absalom's rebellion. And this is why Joab rebukes the king in verse 5. Then Joab came into the house to the king and said, today you have disgraced all your servants who today have saved your life. The lives of your sons and daughters, the lives of your wives and the lives of your concubines, in that you love your enemies and hate your friends. For you have declared today that you regard neither princes nor servants. For today I perceive that if Absalom had lived and all of us had died today, then it would have pleased you well. Wow. Those are some strong words to the king. But that was the impression that David has created. That's the impression that people were taking away. Now therefore, arise and go and speak comfort to your servants. For I swear by the Lord, if you do not go out, and not one will stay with you this night, and that will be worse for you than all the evil that has befallen you from your youth until now. You think you got problems now, David. You keep this up. You refuse to say thanks to the troops. You're going to have real problems on your hands. Hey, who is it tonight that you need to go back to and say thanks to? Sometimes we create a lot of problems for ourselves by failing to say thanks. You know, it seems like one problem is solved and we're on to the next one without really taking the time to stop and count our blessings and say thanks to the people who've helped us. Well, then the king arose and he sat in the gate. And they told all the people, saying, "There is the king sitting in the gate." And so all the people came before the king, for everyone of Israel had fled to his tent. Now all the people were in a dispute throughout all the tribes of Israel, saying, "The king saved us from the hand of our enemies. He delivered us from the hand of the Philistines. And now he has fled from the land because of Absalom. But Absalom, whom we anointed over us, has died in battle. Now, therefore, why do you say nothing about bringing back the king?" In other words, David's popularity rating was so low at this point because of the way he'd handled this victory that some of the people didn't even know if they really wanted him to rule over them again. And this is he's in a bad place here. And so King David said to Zadok and Abiathar the priest, saying, "Speak to the elders of Judah, saying, why are you the last to bring the king back to his house, since the words of all Israel have come to the king, to his very house? You are my brethren, you are my bone and my flesh. Why then are you the last to bring back the king?" David was from the city of Bethlehem that was in the tribe of Judah. And David was losing the men of Judah. He was losing some of his core constituency. And he's concerned about this. He says, "And say to Amasa, are you not bone and my flesh, my bone and my flesh? God do so to me and more also, if you are not commander of the army before me continually in place of Joab." Now this was a twofold move. This was both personal, but it was also political. Amasa was Absalom's general. And he was also from Judah. And by making Amasa joint chief of staff here, David was basically holding out an olive branch to the two parties who were most reluctant to return to the fold and support him as king. The men from Judah and the former followers of Absalom. And so in making Amasa, you know, general, David is basically trying to unify the nation and rally his constituency back in his corner. But his motive here is also personal. For word by now has gotten back to David that the blow that killed Absalom was struck by Joab. And in David's mind, Joab has finally stepped over the line. David has had enough of the Joab way. It's time to reel him in. It's time to put him in his place. And so he swayed the hearts of all the men of Judah, just as the heart of one man, so that they sent this word to the king, "Return, you and all your servants." Then the king returned and came to the Jordan. And Judah came to Gilgal to meet the king. Evidently all this worked. I mean, they received this in the intent that it was given. And so they came back to the king. And they came to escort the king across the Jordan. And Shimei, the son of Gera, a Benjamite, who was from Bahurim, hastened and came down with the men of Judah to meet King David. Now you remember Shimei. He was the guy that when David was leaving Jerusalem, he was the guy who came alongside the road and started hurling curses and throwing stones and kicking up dust at David. And basically, you know, trying to tell him he got what he deserved. You remember this guy. Well, there were 1,000 men of Benjamin with him, and Ziba, the servant of the house of Saul, and his 15 sons, and his 20 servants with him. And they went over the Jordan before the king. Then a ferry boat went across to carry over the king's household and to do what he thought good. You remember the last time David crossed the Jordan was at night, while the world was dark. Now he comes back in the light of day. The first time he crossed the Jordan, he was suffering. Now he comes back victorious. Hey, this is David's second coming. He's coming as king a second time. Keep that in mind. And of course, this is all a type of the Son of David's second coming. Jesus, the Davidic heir, will also come to earth a second time. And Jesus too will return victorious. In his first stint as king of the Jews, Jesus, just like David, was run out of town. He was rejected by his own relatives, the Hebrews. He was betrayed by an Ahithophel, a man by the name of Judas. He was crucified in a coup d'etat. The rebellious hearts of men rejected him. But one day, Jesus is going to return to conquer his enemies. And he's going to come to Jerusalem, and he's going to sit on the throne and reign over this earth forever. Well, verse 18 tells us, "Now Shimei, the son of Gera, he fell down before the king when he had crossed the Jordan." Shimei knows he'd made the wrong choice. He had chosen the wrong side. I mean, he had supported Absalom. He'd been brutal toward David, and now he realized he's made a mistake. And then he said to the king, "Do not let my Lord impute iniquity to me, or remember what wrong your servant did on the day that my Lord the king left Jerusalem, that the king should take it to heart. For I, your servant, know that I have sinned. Therefore, here I am, the first to come today of all the house of Joseph to go down to meet my Lord the king." He repents. He cries out for mercy of how he treated David. But Abishai, the son of Zeruiah, answered and said, "Shall not Shimei be put to death for this, because he cursed the Lord's anointed?" Abishai wanted to kill him when he first started shouting and railing and throwing rocks and kicking dirt and everything else. He wanted to shut his mouth the first time. Now he wants to punish him now. But David said, "What have I to do with you, you sons of Zeruiah, that you should be adversaries to me today? Shall any man be put to death today in Israel?" You know, the sons of Zeruiah remind me of the sons of Zebedee. James and John. Sons of thunder, they were called. They had such fiery tempers, James and John. You remember the story back in Luke chapter 9? When the Samaritans refused to let Jesus pass through their borders, it was James and John who shouted out, "Lord, do you want us to command fire to come down from heaven and consume them, just like Elijah did?" And there we're told Jesus turned and rebuked them and said, "You do not know what manner of spirit you are of. For the Son of Man did not come to destroy men's lives, but to save them." Here, Abishai, he does not know what manner of spirit he is of. This is not a day of judgment. This is an opportunity to show mercy. And nobody was better at it than David. He says, "For I do not know that today I am king over Israel. For do I not know that today I am king over Israel? Therefore the king said to Shimei, 'You shall not die.'" And the king swore to him. As Jesus taught us, David pardoned his enemies. He loved those who reviled and forsook him, just as Jesus does. And even though these Jews hurled insults at David and later will hurl insults at Jesus, you remember when Jesus stands before Pilate, when Jesus carries the cross to Calvary, they too stood at the cross and they mocked Jesus and they hurled their insults. But one day, Jesus will be like David, and he too will forgive the Shimeis, and he will issue pardons as well. Well, verse 24. "Now Mephibosheth, the son of Saul, came down to meet the king. And he had not cared for his feet, nor trimmed his mustache, nor washed his clothes, from the day the king departed until the day he returned in peace." Now, all of this shows that he was truly remorseful over the fact that David had left the city of Jerusalem, that he was a supporter of David. And so it was, when he had come to Jerusalem to meet the king, that the king said to him, "Why did you not go with me, Mephibosheth?" Now you remember, Mephibosheth was crippled. He couldn't walk on his own. His servant Ziba was the one who helped transport him. And you remember what Ziba had told David earlier. He had said that Mephibosheth stayed behind in Jerusalem to support Absalom and to claim part of Saul's inheritance. And as a result, David had given all of Mephibosheth's belongings to Ziba. Oh my. But here we have a different story, don't we? This is not necessarily what happened. This is not what Mephibosheth says has happened. And now Mephibosheth gets an opportunity to speak for himself. He answered, "My lord, O king, my servant deceived me." In other words, Ziba, you know, who said, "I stayed behind to support Absalom," he deceived me. "For your servant said, 'I will saddle a donkey for myself that I may ride on it and go to the king,' because your servant is lame. And he has slandered your servant to my lord the king. But my lord the king is like the angel of God. Therefore, do what is good in your eyes, for all my father's house were but dead men before the Lord the king. Yet you shall set your servant among those who eat at your own table." Mephibosheth is still overwhelmed at David's original generosity. You remember how that on behalf of his father Jonathan, David had adopted Mephibosheth into his own family, and he's still filled with gratitude. But he's saying, you know, "Hey, I've been hoodwinked. You know, Ziba said, 'Hey, you get ready, we'll go out to meet with David.' And then while the crippled guy's getting dressed and all, he runs off and leaves him. And so then he goes out to David and he says, 'Oh, you know, Mephibosheth, he's forsaken you.'" At least that now is Mephibosheth's story. He says, "Therefore, what right have I still to cry out any more to the king?" And this is a wonderful attitude. He thinks David has already been more kind, more generous than he deserves, and he doesn't feel appropriate to bug the king for more. But the king said to him, "Why do you not speak any more of your matters? I have said, 'You and Ziba divide the land.'" Now, I wonder which of these two men David really believed. Did he believe Mephibosheth? Did he believe Ziba? You know, it's possible he had his doubts about both. And that's why he just sort of split the inheritance in half. He couldn't determine which one to believe, and so he just gave half to Mephibosheth, half to Ziba. Maybe there was truth to both stories. You know, you don't really know. Which proves what every marriage counselor already knows. There are two sides to every story. Indeed, there are. And at times it's difficult to determine who's really telling the truth. Well, then Mephibosheth said to the king, "Rather, let him take it all, inasmuch as my lord the king has come back in peace to his own house." What a wonderful sentiment there. Well, David also blesses the house of a man, an old man named Brasiliah. This was the guy who had supplied David food and drink while he was living in exile in Mahanaim. Verse 31. "And Brasiliah the Gileadite came down from Rogelim and went across the Jordan with the king to escort him across the Jordan. Now Brasiliah was a very aged man, 80 years old. And he had provided the king with supplies while he stayed at Mahanaim, for he was a very rich man. And the king said to Brasiliah, 'Come across with me and I will provide for you while you are with me in Jerusalem.' But Brasiliah said to the king, 'How long have I to live that I should go up with the king to Jerusalem? I'm an old man. I'll probably be dead by the time I get to Jerusalem.' He says, 'I am today 80 years old. Can I discern between the good and the bad? Can your servant taste what I eat or what I drink? Can I hear any longer the voice of singing men and singing women? Why then should your servant be a further burden to my lord the king? Your servant will go a little way across the Jordan with the king, and why should the king repay me with such a reward?'" It's amazing that Brasiliah did such a simple thing. You remember, he brought the king a few supplies. That's basically all he did. He brought him a few bedrolls, some canned goods, some wheat, some beans, some lentils, some seeds, some honey and curds, some cheese, just the basic stuff. Wasn't a big sacrifice at all. In fact, we're told that this guy was a very rich man. But now David returns and he wants to reward Brasilia. And it just goes to show me that it doesn't take much to get a reward from Jesus. I think sometimes we're under this wrong conception that if we're not out, you know, taking the gospel to the pygmies in the deepest, darkest jungle and risking our lives and climbing over mountains and swimming through alligator-infested rivers, you know, we're not going to get anything from the Lord. We won't get a reward. But to me, this story shows me that it doesn't take much. Jesus is so good with his gifts. He's so quick to reward us. Hey, when he comes back, Jesus too is going to give rewards. And it might not take as much as we think to get in line for a crown or two. Got any lentils? Can you pass the cheese to a needy person? And you know, it's never too late to rack up some rewards. Notice this. Brasilia was 80 years old. I think I got a picture of him. That's my idea of Brasilia. He said he'd lost his wits. He couldn't discern good and bad. Said he lost his taste. He was hard of hearing. The poor guy was barely able to walk. And yet none of that mattered. It didn't stop him from sharing his stuff. Here's what Brasilia did. And he got a reward from Jesus. He saw a need that he could meet and he met it. And when he gets to heaven, he's going to hear, "Well done, good and faithful servant." Did you realize it is really just that simple to get a reward from Jesus? See a need you can meet and just meet it. And one day you'll get a reward from Jesus. Just pass the cheese, man. A cup of beans earns a crown of blessing. Isn't that amazing? "Well, please let your servant turn back again, that I may die in my own city near the grave of my father and mother. But here is your servant, Chimam. Let him cross over with my lord the king and do for him what seems good to you." And the king answered, "Chimam shall cross over with me, and I will do for him what seems good to you. Now whatever you request of me, I will do for you." Then all the people went over the Jordan, and when the king had crossed over, the king kissed Brasilia. And he blessed him, and he returned to his own place. At the end of chapter 19, a squabble erupts between the northern tribes of Israel and the southern tribe of Judah over who is going to escort the king to Jerusalem. It amazes me. Just a few months earlier, he had exited the capital in disgrace. No one was claiming David. The fickleness of people. You know, few people stood with David in the tough times. But now that the bandwagon is rolling again, it's all aboard. Everybody's wanting a piece of the king now that he's popular. Verse 40. "Now the king went on to Gilgal, and Chinnam went on with him. And all the people of Judah escorted the king, and also half the people of Israel. And just then all the men of Israel came to the king and said to the king, 'Why have our brethren, the men of Judah, stolen you away and brought the king, his household, and all David's men with him across the Jordan?' So all the men of Judah answered the men of Israel, 'Because the king is a close relative of ours.' 'Why then are you angry over this matter? Have we ever eaten at the king's expense, or has he given us any gift?' And the men of Israel answered the men of Judah and said, 'We have 10 shares in the king,'" since they were 10 tribes in the north. "'Therefore, we also have more right to David than you. Why then do you despise us? Were we not the first to advise bringing back our king?' Yet the words of the men of Judah were fiercer than the words of the men of Israel." And apparently Judah won out. But this little riff at the end of chapter 19, it creates another rebellion in chapter 20. Sheba balks at the tribe of Judah's claim to David. And he organizes his own revolt. And there happened to be a rebel whose name was Sheba, the son of Bichri, a Benjamite. And he blew a trumpet and said, "We have no share in David, nor do we have inheritance in the son of Jesse. Every man to his tents, O Israel." So every man of Israel deserted David and followed Sheba, the son of Bichri. And the men of Judah from the Jordan as far as Jerusalem remained loyal to their king. And so the same split occurs that we've seen before. The 10 tribes in the north, they rallied together to form one larger tribe. Or they rallied together to form sort of their own entity. And then the larger tribe in the south, Judah, they sort of rallied together. And so it's Israel in the north versus Judah in the south. Now, David came to his house at Jerusalem. And the king took the 10 women, his concubines, whom he had left to keep the house, and put them in seclusion and supported them, but did not go into them. You remember they had been defiled by Absalom. And so they were shut up to the day of their death, living in widowhood. And the king said to Amasa, "Assemble the men of Judah for me within 3 days and be present here yourself." So Amasa went to assemble the men of Judah, but he delayed longer than the set time which David had appointed him. And David said to Abishai, "Now Sheba, the son of Bichri, will do us more harm than Absalom. Take your Lord's servants and pursue him, lest he find for himself fortified cities and escape us." And so Joab's men with the Cherethites and the Pelethites, who were David's personal bodyguards, and all the mighty men went out after him. And they went out of Jerusalem to pursue Sheba, the son of Bichri. Now when they were at the large stone, which is in Gibeon, Amasa came before them. Now Joab was dressed in battle armor. On it was a belt with a sword fastened in its sheath at his hips. And as he was going forward, it fell out. The Jewish historian Josephus says that Joab dropped the sword intentionally so that he would have an excuse to approach Amasa with an unsheathed sword, with a naked sword. Then Joab said to Amasa, "Are you in health, my brother?"
"If you are, it's not going to last long." Said it under his breath, I guess.
And Joab took Amasa by the beard with his right hand to kiss him. Be careful of a kiss. Jesus was betrayed by a kiss. How many people do you know have been betrayed by a kiss, a fake show of affection and loyalty? But Amasa did not notice the sword that was in Joab's hand, and he struck him with it in the stomach, and his entrails poured out on the ground, and he did not strike him again. Didn't need to. Thus he died. Amasa was Joab's rival. A very dangerous position to be in, Joab's rival. And Joab does to Amasa exactly what he'd done earlier to Abner. He guts him like a fresh fish. Well, then Joab and Abishai, his brother, they pursued Sheba, the son of Bichri. Meanwhile, one of Joab's men stood near Amasa and said, "Whoever favors Joab and whoever is for David, follow Joab." But Amasa wallowed in his blood in the middle of the highway. And when the men saw that all the people stood still, he moved Amasa from the highway to the field and threw a garment over him. When he saw that everyone who had come upon him halted. Amasa's murder was done in broad daylight. Joab made no attempt whatsoever to keep it a secret. He stabbed his rival by the road and left him squirming and writhing in his own pool of blood right between the white lines. I mean, this was a cold-blooded, unwarranted murder, an injustice, a selfish act of power grabbing. And the people, they halted. They stopped when they saw the evidence, when they saw Amasa squirming in the middle of the road. But notice this. But when he was removed from the highway, all the people went on after Joab. In other words, out of sight, out of mind. Did you know this is why abortion is still legal in our country? because it is an invisible crime. No one sees the victims. No one sees their torture. If an injustice doesn't make it into the headlines, folks tend to forget it. Or as soon as it's gone from the headlines, out of sight, out of mind. Sweep the issue under the rug. Just sort of sweep it out of the way, and people will neglect it. They'll go on their merry way. They'll forget that it ever happened. Nothing's really changed from these times until today. Well, when he was removed from the highway, all the people went on after Joab to pursue Sheba, the son of Bichri. And he went through all the tribes of Israel to Abel and Beth Maacah and all the Barites. And so they were gathered together and also went after Sheba. Then they came and besieged him in Abel of Beth Maacah. And they cast up a siege mound against the city, and it stood by the rampart. And all the people who were with Joab, they battered the wall to throw it down. Then a wise woman cried out from the city, "Hear, hear, please say to Joab, come nearby that I may speak with you." And when he had come near to her, the woman said, "Are you Joab?" And he answered, "I am." And then she said to him, "Hear the words of your maidservant." And he answered, "I'm listening." And so she spoke, saying, "They used to talk in former times, saying, they shall surely seek guidance at Abel, and so they would end disputes. I am among the peaceable and faithful in Israel. You seek to destroy a city and a mother in Israel. Why would you swallow up the inheritance of the Lord?" And Joab answered and said, far be it from me that I should swallow up or destroy. That is not so, but a man from the mountains of Ephraim, Sheba the son of Bichri by name, has raised his hand against the king, against David. Deliver him only, and I will depart from the city. I'll spare the whole city. Just want the guy." So the woman said to Joab, "Watch, his head will be thrown to you over the wall." Then the woman, in her wisdom, went to all the people, and they cut off the head of Sheba, the son of Bichri, and threw it out to Joab. Once again, this has happened before. Once again, Joab goes out to battle, and David gets ahead. Just amazing. David gets ahead again. Happened again. "And then he blew a trumpet, and they withdrew from the city, every man to his tent. So Joab returned to the king at Jerusalem." Chapter 20 ends with a list of David's cabinet in the latter years of his reign. And Joab was over all the army of Israel. Benaiah, the son of Jehoiada, was over the Cherethites and the Pelethites. Adoram was in charge of revenue, or the head of the IRS. Now it's interesting. In the previous list of David's cabinet, you can go back and look at it in chapter 8. There was no such position as in charge of revenue. That's because in the early years of David's reign, the government was being supported by the spoils of battle. David was winning victories and taking the loot, and it was stuffing the coffers. But in the later years of his reign, he had to start levying taxes, and thus the need for someone in charge of revenue. Jehoshaphat, the son of Ahilud, was the recorder, the state historian. Sheva was the scribe, the secretary of state. Zadok and Abiathar were the priests. And Ira the Jerite was a chief minister under David. And again, if you compare this list with the previous one, Ira replaces David's sons as his chief ministers. Evidently, David's family had become so corrupt that they could no longer be trusted with high levels in his government. And so they're replaced by this man named Ira. And there we have chapter 20 of 2 Samuel. Next week, I'll be in Israel. And so we're going to be having a special Christmas evening next Sunday night. You'll want to be here for that. Next Sunday morning,